Welcome to the CenturyLink Labs podcast with your host, Lucas Carlson. From Docker and Linux containers to programming languages and web frameworks, we interview technology and thought leaders around the world every week. This week's interview is brought to you by CenturyLink Cloud, the world's fastest self-service enterprise-grade cloud.
Hello, this is Lucas Carlson with the CenturyLink Labs podcast. This week, I've got an awesome guest for you, David Strauss, who is the CTO of Pantheon. Now, Pantheon is a really interesting company. It grew up sort of a similar time frame around the platform as a service industry. It came around, but it focused, instead of things like Heroku and AppFog going and creating platform as a service technologies for all sorts of different technologies and languages, Java and Node and Python and Ruby, Pantheon did something really interesting. They focused. They focused really on Drupal and doing kind of the best managed, hosted Drupal that you can get out there. They've built a great business, a great service. They're doing awesome work around Drupal, and if you need Drupal services, you should totally check it out. And so today we have David Strauss, who is the genius technology person behind Pantheon. And the reason I brought him on is because recently they made a post that was really fascinating that talked about why they built Pantheon with containers instead of virtual machines. I thought that was a super interesting post, and I'll link to it in the show notes, but that really piqued my interest. So I wanted to dig in deep and talk to the technology brains behind it. So we've got David on. David, can you tell us about your background?
Okay. Before Pantheon, for 4 years, I was one of the founders of a company in Austin called Four Kitchens, where we would do professional services for some of the largest Drupal sites on the web. We did things for The Economist, for NBC Universal, et cetera. And we would work on these huge projects, and then we would also sometimes parachute into projects in flight where they were having issues with either scalability or developer workflow, and we would try and kind of get them back on the same track. And largely, Pantheon is born of that experience, where we wanted to create the ultimate tool both for the customers we had and for the kind of company that all the founders worked for. All the other founders did professional services before Pantheon as well. And we wanted it where you would get the very best tools for workflow management from the very beginning of a project with no upfront cost. And then we also wanted it to be where you'd be able to scale upwards and outwards consistently and predictably in a way that wouldn't have the kind of huge transition from developer infrastructure and testing infrastructure to production, where there would be lots of surprises on launch because production would operate differently than the environment that you had been working in. And largely, I think Pantheon's delivered on that. We have an infrastructure where you actually, at no cost, you can get those developer tools from the very beginning of a project. And then we keep our design of the infrastructure consistent from our free accounts all the way up to the very largest enterprise ones.
That's really, really cool. So we'll dig into the technology, but let's get to the first question first. Why did you build Pantheon with containers? What was it about containers that drew you away from virtual machines?
Well, it goes right to those primary drivers that we had for designing the product for the company, where we wanted it where you would have a consistent experience, and when it comes to virtual machines, it's very hard to provide a consistent experience from a single developer instance up through production, because you often have a situation where production is maybe a fleet of virtual machines that are interlinked, and developer instances are either a VM per developer or maybe a couple that are shared between developers, and then you're going from local access to the database to network database access. You're going from local file system to something like GlusterFS. You're going from maybe no Varnish cache to having a Varnish cache. You're going from no CDN to having a CDN. And all these were major consistency issues, even in terms of the tools you would have available, especially when people would do local development. They would experience things like not having access to Redis or Memcache in local development, and then when they got to production, it would be there. They might not have Solr in their local development, but it might be available in test in production. And we wanted to erase that. And the way to be able to deploy that in a way where everything, we'd be able to provide that at a reasonable price to everyone, was to use containers. And the reason is that you can't deploy a fleet of virtual machines for every single developer and every single environment along deployment at a reasonable cost. If you do that, you would be spending probably tens of thousands on your developer infrastructure and test infrastructure if you had maybe even a team of 10 or 20 people, because it would require huge amounts of overhead for every database server, every file server, etc. With containers, we can actually still spread the application over the network, but only take a small slice of each system. So you have a small size container that is running the application server on one server, a small container that's running the database server on another server. It connects to the network file system that we've developed internally. It connects to a Solr core that's on another server. And the actual size of those resources is small, just even when they're running. And then because we can start them and stop them on demand when they're actually accessed, it means that even that footprint of memory and CPU is not even a persistent thing. It's only there when it's being used. So you can test out the app with the full fleet of services and the full stack that's representative of the later stages of deployment without us busting the bank for ourselves or our customers trying to deliver that consistent experience. And then even once you get to production, you don't necessarily want to scale up production at the full server level. You don't want to add 1 to 5,000 a month in your monthly cost just because you need to crank the dial a little bit. And you certainly don't want to have any kind of longer-term commitment to that or a long time before you can get those resources. Because when it comes to spiking traffic on a site, you need the resources now, and later you might not need them anymore. And with containers, they're lightweight enough that we can deploy them quickly and retract them quickly. And then we run a large enough grid of servers that we have enough spare capacity to meet any customer need on our infrastructure, where even their very best day is only going to be a tiny blip in the overall edge traffic we process. So we can turn a dial to say this person needs 30 application servers, and within probably under a minute or so, they'll have all of those provisioned and running the application, and traffic will be being distributed among all of those.
That is awesome. So that makes complete sense. It's a higher density. It's the ability to scale faster and easier and not have to pay up front for things you might not use. So you've been using containers a while, but you don't use Docker. Docker is obviously a super hot technology. It seems like everyone's using it these days. Why don't you use Docker?
Well, our container approach predates Docker by multiple years. We've been using containers since around 2011 on Pantheon's platform, and the Linux kernel itself doesn't actually have a concept of containers. It has a whole set of different APIs that when they're all used in unison, it gives you something that looks like a container. So it's not like zones on Solaris or jails on BSD in the sense that there's kind of one monolithic thing that you configure that creates that isolation. On Linux, there are mandatory access controls, there are capability filters, there are C groups, and there are namespaces, and probably one or two others other than just kind of the standard users and groups. And if you configure enough of those to isolate a process or set of processes, then you get something that looks like a container. And that's why we call them containers, because for all purposes, they are practically the same as containers on other platforms that have that concept at the kernel level. And what Docker does is it configures all those resources for you. And that's what we use systemd to do for our systems. It configures the namespaces, it configures the C groups, it launches the application within them, and then it runs in something that's basically a container. because we flipped all the switches on. The main addition that Docker does, in addition to what you can do with just those, with configuring those facilities, is it provides a kind of deployment packaging model and infrastructure for kind of publishing those containers and then other people installing them. Unfortunately, the design goals of Docker haven't aligned as well with some of our needs, where we've long had technology for configuring what's in the container. We basically run Chef, but kind of set the context to be the container itself rather than the base system. And then that's served our needs there. And our density needs are considerably more advanced than what Docker provides right now, where I mentioned how we can start the containers on demand when they're in use. And we do that through a technology called socket activation, where systemd sits on the base system. It opens up the listener, which is separate from actually serving the requests on Linux. It puts an epoll listener on there. And the reason why that's important is it allows it to identify that a connection is coming in, but not actually process it. Like the way that the Linux kernel handles sockets is it's decoupled the idea of processing the request and realizing one has come in. So systemd realizes that a request has come in, and then it can use that to activate a service or container on the system, where it starts up the service, and then what it does is it hands that socket into the service, because on Linux, and like most Unix systems, every socket is a file descriptor, which is kind of this numbered thing that you can hand off by, you can kind of clean up and then fork and then hand that off. And it hands that off to the child, and then the child actually goes into the normal processing routine, which is called kind of an accept loop, usually, where it's the idea of, okay, if there is a request waiting, handle it, or wait until one comes in. Or it might actually set up its own event listener, if it's something like Nginx, to wait for hearing those events itself. And then that that actually allows us to decouple the idea of realizing there's a request coming in and actually handling it in a way where we can kind of hibernate our containers using a tool we call the Reaper. And it walks through, it finds ones that are not responding, that are not actively processing requests, that have not been actively processing requests for a while, that may be associated with some of our lower plan levels. And then it kind of hibernates those. So there's no resident CPU load, there's no resident memory load, not even in the swap file. And when the request comes in, it takes a few seconds to bring that back online. And that's one of the key technologies we get because we use that for about 95% of our containers at any point in time. We deploy thousands of containers to any given box, but only about 5 to 10% of them are running at any point.
Wow, that's super interesting. Is any of this open source, or is any of this software that somebody else could use to reproduce?
Yes, all the stuff we do for socket activation is entirely open source, and it's all built into the systemd project. I've actually published some of the things to the systemd wiki for better support of that, and I've worked with systemd's lead, Leonard, to improve the design of socket activation for doing things like container launches on demand. But that's actually shipping extremely broadly now. Back when we started with systemd, it was only on Fedora. But now it's on SUSE, it'll be on the next Ubuntu release, it'll be on it's on the latest Red Hat Enterprise Linux 7 that came out, I think, a month or two ago, as well as CentOS 7. So the access to this kind of architecture is now available to almost everyone except for Ubuntu LTS.
And it's in systemd, or is it a separate project name?
It's in systemd. You basically separately configure a listener as a socket unit, and then in the service itself, you can have that start a container with something called inspawn. It also integrates with Red Hat's libvirt infrastructure to do activation of LXC containers. And it's mostly an issue of configuring it at that point, which I've published some sample configurations to the systemd wiki for doing it with Nginx and PHP FPM, and I think maybe one other tool, where you can actually trick a lot of daemons into thinking that they're reloading their configuration, and then they'll accept an inherited socket. Because the way that Nginx and PHP FPM actually handle their safe reload without interrupting request availability is by forking off a new child and then handing off the current listeners into the new child. And then basically once the child appears to be fully operational, the parent just kind of dies off. And then, so they basically kind of socket activate their child, and that chain can continue indefinitely. And the reason that can continue indefinitely without any performance impact is because there's no proxy involved. Like, nothing is actually copying the bytes from one thing to another. When you hand off a socket this way, it is completely natively in the kernel. There's no performance degradation versus the application having created the listener itself.
Super interesting. This is fascinating stuff. So what about the security? Is there is the security profile of using containers this way any different than using Docker for security?
Well, systemd inspun has full support for mandatory access controls with SC Linux. And the reason that is an important approach to security on containers is because there are kind of root escalation vulnerabilities that come across all the time, where someone realizes if you call this kind of thing in the kernel and give it this kind of data, then you can basically escalate your current user to root. But once you pair that with SE Linux, you're operating the current process in a label as well, which gives you access to certain resources. There's this kind of great cartoon that one of the main maintainers and promoters of SE Linux, I don't know if he commissioned it or found it, but it basically shows this kind of idea of, let's say you had a cat and a dog as pets, and you had food bowls for them, and you labeled them. One said dog and one said cat. SE Linux is basically a tool that ensures that the dog can only eat out of the bowl labeled dog, and the cat can only eat out of the bowl labeled cat. And even if one of them kind of found a way to base, in normal permissions, it would be like, let's say you had a wall between them and they never saw each other. But even if they broke through that wall and were able to walk right up to the other bowl of the other animal, SE Linux would deny the ability to eat there because the labels don't match. So it makes the attack considerably harder. You not only have to acquire root, you also have to find a way out either through the SE Linux state machine or to manipulate your label so that you can access more than you were granted access to. And labels work great with containers because you just label everything in the container one thing, and you launch the stuff in the container with that label and only with permissions to access that label. And even if the stuff in that container got root, it wouldn't have permission to really write to or read from anything else in the base system other than the things that you've granted it access to. So it's just like a nice defense in depth thing where it's not a panacea, but it means that a lot of root escalation vulnerabilities, if you actually read in detail about them, they'll say if you're properly using SE Linux, this doesn't actually affect you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So are you considering or thinking about porting back some of this Reaper spawn ideas back into Docker and potentially adopting Docker in the future? Or are you thinking that the stuff you're working on with systemd is good enough and you don't really need to share the file systems and have that collaboration kind of on the Docker Hub sort of style thing?
We have a couple services that we're running more centrally, running in Docker containers, just because it's a convenient way to package an application that's always running. We haven't looked at using it directly for our users' containers yet because of that lack of on-demand launching. So far, Upstream at Docker hasn't been receptive to including the kind of changes necessary to support on-demand launching. Although it looks like Red Hat is starting to maintain a patch set for Docker for the version that they're probably going to be shipping with some of the newer releases on Fedora and Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and then of course CentOS and derivative ones too, where it would support that. I'm chatting with some of their engineers about that because they have some use cases where it really fits. Like they have the OpenShift project.
Yes.
Which is moving to Kubernetes, Docker, plus Docker as its foundation. But they don't run Docker directly. They run Docker with something called GearD, which is more like CoreOS. In fact, I believe a large portion of the code is actually from CoreOS for Gear D. And the difference there is, instead of provisioning a container that Dockerd launches and runs and monitors, it creates a systemd service, and then it runs Docker within that systemd service. So this is what CoreOS is doing, this is what Gear D is doing, this is what OpenShift will be doing. And then that actually opens the door to doing socket activation if you patch Docker to kind of hand off the socket into the container. And the so the reason I'm bringing this up is because OpenShift has a similar need to be able to launch containers on demand. Currently, they do that at a kind of layer 7 level, where it's like application protocol level. They'll have an HTTP proxy on the machine that'll notice that a request is coming in for a certain container, and then maybe they can either delay that or send a page down saying this container is coming online, and then they can start the container and start proxying. But you have to have a layer 7 proxy to do that, and it doesn't have a really clean way to kind of hold the request until the container launches for all of these protocols. It's kind of very application specific. So we'll see where that goes. We're hoping here at Pantheon that they see socket activation as kind of the future model of how you kind of say that a container needs to listen on something and then have it start when a request comes in, so that you can have an on-demand launching model that is that doesn't require a lot of complexity.
Awesome. Makes a ton of sense. So since you brought up OpenShift, what do you think of platform as a service? And what are you guys looking into using OpenShift? Have you looked at Cloud Foundry? What's your opinion about the whole PaaS space?
We looked at Cloud Foundry years and years ago, back in around 2011. It was not a great project then. From the folks I've talked to at Pivotal, it's improved absolutely incredibly since then, but I haven't taken a fresh look at it. So I can't really talk to where Cloud Foundry is at, although I know that they have some uptake. I know that as AppFog, you guys were based on Cloud Foundry and improved it a lot. Like, we didn't want to do that if we already had some stuff that was working. So I haven't looked at that in a while. I'm more familiar with what's going on the OpenShift side because I have a lot more connections with Red Hat and the Fedora community. And we're probably not going to use OpenShift directly because it's pretty heavyweight. It requires running a lot of components to be able to get the infrastructure set up. We're much more interested in container orchestration with something lighter weight like Kubernetes or CoreOS, where we can have APIs and then provision containers in the boxes, maybe migrate or hibernate or do other things that we need to do with those containers without having a full-on kind of GUI and authentication layer and manager and all the other kind of infrastructure that goes hand-in-hand with something like OpenShift. That said, it will become a lot more attractive once it's based on Kubernetes, Docker, and they've gotten the kind of on-demand launching stuff going. Because the other thing that Red Hat insists on for OpenShift is mandatory access control for containers. They're not using normal LXC for containers right now in OpenShift. They're using this kind of SE Linux thing that also still uses like C groups and namespaces. But the other thing they're looking at patching Docker for, and I think they've already done on the Red Hat versions, is support for SE Linux. So that even though we may not use OpenShift directly, they're pushing for a lot of changes in certain components that we find very attractive.
Cool. Have you looked into any of the Docker PaaSes like Flynn or Deus or Doku? Have you researched those?
Into what?
Any of the Docker PaaSes like Flynn or Deus or Doku?
We haven't. The main issue with a lot of those in terms of us running our product is that all of those are based on a kind of billing model where you pay for the container and then you're paying persistently for that container to run indefinitely until you stop paying. Or maybe there's some very small entry level that you get free. But our model is based on several kinds of compounded efficiency. One is that we're moving more of our systems in the direction of bare metal with containers on them, which is massively cheaper than even just occupying an entire VM in the cloud, because we have very predictable provisioning needs in terms of our customer growth path and the container growth we need. We can literally know 30 days in advance when we need that stuff, and some of the things like Rackspace on metal is providing API-based provisioning for metal where there's not really any downside as long as you have a way to slice up the system. And then, so we get our underlying compute cheap because we eat all of it. We don't use VMs as kind of our isolation or packaging layer. We get tons of density from the kind of on-demand container stuff. Like, we're 20-fold as efficient as running all the containers all the time right there. And then we also get massive underlying efficiencies by having the same by the way we distribute binaries and libraries on the system, where we have them on the base OS layer, and then we have the container use those. But one thing that's nice that Linux does is, no matter how many containers are mapping a binary, because the architecture of the system distinguishes broadly between kind of data and executable pages, and those executable pages are shared and unwritable, what happens is every single container that is running is mapping mostly the same set of executable and library pages. So that provides many gigabytes of memory saving on the system from not having every single person map, say, PHP 5.5 plus all the libraries and other binaries that that's using, and maybe some of the other things that are running in the container. Because every single mapping of those is hundreds of megabytes of RAM. And so if you look at some of those kind of Docker-based PaaS platforms, they're running all the containers all the time. They're mapping the binaries and libraries completely for every single container. And then they're usually buying their infrastructure at a smaller scale than we are right now. Because even though they may be a generic PaaS, we're one of the largest customers on the cloud infrastructures that we're on. And so we're probably paying cheaper for VMs, and we're paying massively cheaper for the hardware.
Makes a lot of sense. So do you use containers primarily on virtual machines or on bare metal today?
Primarily on virtual machines, because we had a project called Pod 1 that was a rack of bare metal hardware we were running for a while, but it was provisioned in a more traditional way, and it was kind of painful to manage. Like, we really like API-based provisioning, even though we have pretty predictable needs and a long enough lead time that we could predict a month in advance that we need a machine. But OnMetal's changing that a lot for us. Like, we're waiting for that to come to some of the data centers we're in, or looking at getting presence in those data centers. We kind of were like a launch partner with Rackspace for that, and we had participated with them in part of the design of the system, in terms of like them coming to us and asking like what do we need, and what do we see as part of the future of infrastructure. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we move almost entirely to that within Rackspace data centers, because it's just somewhere between 2 to 3 times cheaper than cloud infrastructure. Because with cloud, you're paying, of course, a few percentage cost for just the idea of having a hypervisor. And even on the machines where we have hypervisors, we typically are getting them at the full size of the base computer. Like, we're single-tenant VMs on these boxes that we get. Like, they're a 64-gigabyte box, and then we have a 60-gigabyte VM on there. And the other 4 gigs is just kind of overhead for running the base system, the hypervisor layer. So we're paying a little bit of a penalty there. And then in terms of storage provisioning and how long we keep around the VM, that means that you're basically having to pay a premium for that as well. Like, one of the important things to remember with all cloud infrastructure is you may be buying the machines on demand, but you're paying an overhead for them to maintain those spare machines ready to go, because that's how they're able to provide them on demand, is they have some percentage of extra infrastructure lying around that they're certainly charging people money for. It they're just distributing the cost to all of their customers. And with OnMetal and the way that we're working with Rackspace for infrastructure planning, we have some great options for kind of planning that out better. Where if we have more predictable needs, then our provider can have better prediction of when they need to have things. Like, there will never be a time in the next month where we suddenly need 100 machines and then we don't need those 100 machines anymore. That's just not how we run our infrastructure. Yep. We're not doing batch processing of data or anything like that. We're running real-time applications that need to be consistently available, and that we have a kind of predictable curve of customer growth.
Makes total sense. Do you think that the container revolution is going to push more people into moving away from virtual machine cloud into back into bare metal? Do you think that's going to be a trend that we'll see over the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, certainly with products like OnMetal, where you can provision the full machine in exactly the same way you provision a VM, that will change a lot. It really depends on what someone's running. Like, a lot of people who use VMs, I don't think really would know what to do with the full-size machines with even if they could slice them up with containers, where if you have an application that takes 4 gigs and another application that takes another 4 gigs, what do you do with a machine that has 128 gigs of RAM? Like that, and when it comes to OnMetal, everything's going to get provisioned at the kind of sweet spot of price and performance, where they would never have a OnMetal machine with 4 gigs of RAM, because that's not an economical size of machine to run. Data centers are confined by space on the racks and power, which power kind of goes hand in hand with cooling. And so they're looking at what density they can deliver computing on those racks. And the one thing that VMs still provide is that if all you need is less than the sweet spot of a computer, and you don't have a kind of standardized application that you can deploy to, say, a PaaS, then VMs are still a great choice. And they will probably persistently offer those for that kind of reason. Like if all you want to do is run an email server or something. The other challenge to kind of the container, I don't even really consider it a challenge, the container revolution, it's kind of almost a complementary thing, are the super lightweight VMs, where you don't run a full operating system and a full kind of init layer and a full application layer and all the libraries in a VM. You basically, you have a VM with a minimal kernel and just the application. And so the kernel only has device support for the virtualized devices provided by the VM. And one of the biggest things of progress over the last 5 or so years is that VMs now have these kind of high-level virtualized devices, where it used to be that VMs would do this thing where they would emulate a popular kind of hardware at the time, and then you'd be able to run something in the VM because the OS had drivers for that kind of hardware. Like, it would look like an Intel network card. Well, it's a lot better now, because instead of making something that looks like real hardware, you have these kind of fake high-level hardware devices where you can do these kind of high-level operations for sending packets, etc., that don't try to have all the intricacy of regular hardware. And those are devices that will never appear in the real world, but appear when you're a virtualized environment. And then so there are these thin VMs where the kernel just supports those kind of devices, which requires less code, less overhead. They look identical no matter where it's deployed, because it's this kind of high-level API for the hardware. And this is especially true for network layer at this point. Putting all those VMs onto kind of a switch on the hypervisor. And then within the VM, you don't run the whole user land world. You just have kind of like PHP FPM. It's like a kernel plus PHP FPM, or a kernel plus a kind of Rails runtime, or a kernel plus a Java runtime. The Java one's probably the furthest along. And that's all you deploy in there. And so the actual overhead of the OS is in the, you know, under 100 megabytes. In terms of both the size of on disk and the amount of memory it takes, and then the rest of memory's application layer. And now that doesn't get all the efficiencies we get with containers right now, but it provides better isolation for security and performance, because that means it gets its own kind of page table enforced by the hardware. It means it gets the kind of, you can't really exploit the hypervisor kernel in the same way, because it's enforced by the actual processor as a separate system. And then you're only paying a couple percent in terms of kind of CPU performance because of the virtualization, which that continues to drop all the time, especially with these kind of super thin VMs. And so that's really interesting. What's even more interesting about it is you can't really run those on VMs, because virtualization within virtualization, if it's available, is really immature. So what you really need is OnMetal kind of hardware for that. So whether you're doing traditional bare metal deployment or you're doing some sort of API provisioning for bare metal, I think that is the future of provisioning, because whether you're running just containers to slice up the system or whether you're running these super lightweight VMs, then I think that has to be the foundation for those things, whether it's for cost or capability.
Yeah, that is super, super interesting. Well, I really appreciate picking your mind about this stuff, because you're obviously like cutting edge on all this stuff, and it's these ideas, you're just blowing my mind. So I really appreciate it. One last question. What do you think about Hack and the Facebook alternative to PHP?
Well, the great thing about Hack is it's not an alternative to PHP. Hack is an additional layer within their HHVM that allows you to port existing code and write new code that supports the new semantics of Hack, which are kind of better typing, typing is one of the key things in there. It's just better for complex projects, but it's all running in the same it's all running in the same kind of just-in-time compiled virtual machine, which is HHVM. So PHP can call Hack. I believe Hack can call PHP. It's just no big deal. It's more like it's more akin to one of those major releases of Java, where Java starts introducing things like closures or other features to the JVM. And all the existing code runs on that, but you can write new code that supports those features or rewrite existing code to make use of those features, and it still retains complete compatibility. Like, it doesn't have any of the overhead of calling anything out of process. You can iterate gradually by porting code over, and that's neat, because the biggest problem with moving code around with PHP is that really the only option with the standard Zend runtime is you can write a C extension, which has a really nasty API. Like, it's hard. Like, it's like halfway C and halfway macros, and it's one of some of the ugliest stuff I've ever seen. And so, and even though that you can call PHP from you can call those things in C, and you can call things in PHP from the C extensions, but it's just so alien, the two worlds in terms of native C versus PHP, that it's just difficult, because everything in PHP is a Zeval, which is this kind of like hybrid. Like, when you get into C, it's basically this struct that simultaneously can contain either an integer or a double or a string or like any of these things. And so once you get that into C, it's just no fun to deal with. And then once you're calling back into PHP, you have to basically convert those things. And HHVM is much, much cleaner, where it's not like you're dealing with a completely different development model in terms of memory management or types. You could basically look at a function and say, okay, well, I would add this and change this, and now it's a Hack function. And it doesn't change how your developers work either. Like, C extensions, you have to compile, and then you have to put those in the runtime, and then you have to restart the runtime, and then you can access them. And that means that the kind of learning curve and the way you integrate it into your development workflow is completely different.
So you think Hack's here to stay then?
The biggest concern I think a lot of people have about Hack is it isn't supported at all by the Zend runtime. So as soon as you start including Hack code in your stuff, you're basically saying the only way I can run this application is HHVM, which Facebook is trying to mitigate that with a new initiative where they're trying to jointly standardize the PHP language with the kind of Zend engine, which is the standard PHP runtime, so that there's an agreed-upon standard. Perhaps PHP either ignores some of the Hack extensions or kind of iterates on supporting them, but ultimately they want more unification of the language, where you can start using more of the features of, say, Hack or HHVM without never being able to look back, because it's a pretty big hop right now. We have some experimental support for HHVM on Pantheon, where in our kind of debug panel we can switch an environment to running on it, and we demoed it at DrupalCon in Austin with kind of performance benchmarks, and it is a pretty massive improvement in performance. So it's pretty exciting, and we don't have that as kind of a customer thing. Like, even if a customer asked for it, we probably wouldn't turn it on, because it's not really in a position for us to support. But we definitely built our system so that we can have that as an option long term.
Awesome. Well, this has been really great. I know you're a busy guy, so I'll let you go. But thanks for coming on, and I'd love to catch up with you in a little bit, see how we've made progress in the next year or so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the CenturyLink Labs podcast with Lucas Carlson. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, CenturyLinkLabs.com, to your friends and colleagues. Be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous podcasts. This has been a CenturyLink production. Join us next time for another edition of the CenturyLink Labs podcast.